Chapter 5. The Holy Man of Makovets Hill. "Father," said Sasha, vibrating with excitement, "the priest says there's a holy man north of Moscow, on Makovets Hill. He has founded a monastery and gathered already 11 disciples. They say he talks with angels. Every day many go to seek his blessing." Pyotr grunted. He had been in Moscow a week already, enduring the business of currying favor. His latest effort, only just concluded, had been a visit to the Tatar emissary, the Baskak. No man from Sarai, that jewel box city built by the conquering horde, would deign to be impressed by the paltry offerings of a northern lord. But Pyotr had doggedly pressed furs upon him. Heaps of fox and ermine, rabbit and sable passed beneath the emissary's calculating gaze until at last he looked less condescending and thanked Pyotr with every appearance of goodwill. Such furs fetched much gold in the court of the Khan, and further south, among the princes of Byzantium. It was worth it, thought Pyotr. I might be glad one day to have a friend among the conquerors. Pyotr was weary and sweating in his gold-threaded finery, but he could not rest, for here was his second son on fire with eagerness, bearing a tale of holy men and miracles.
"There are always holy men," Pyotr said to Sasha.
He knew a sudden longing for quiet and for plain food. The Muscovites were fond of Byzantine cookery, and the resulting collision with Russian ingredients did his stomach no favors. Tonight, there was to be more feasting and more intrigue. He still sought a wife for himself and a husband for Olga.
"Father," said Sasha, "I should like to go to this monastery, if I may."
"Sashka, you cannot cast a stone without hitting a church in this city," said Pyotr. "Why waste 3 days riding on another?"
Sasha's lip curled. "In Moscow, priests are in love with their standing. They eat fat meat and preach poverty to the miserable." This was true. But Pyotr, though a good lord to his people, lacked an abstract sense of justice. He shrugged.
"Your holy men might be the same."
"Nonetheless, I should like to see. Please, Father."
Sasha, though gray-eyed, had his mother's jet brows and long lashes. They swept down, oddly delicate against his thin face. Pyotr considered. Roads were dangerous, but the well-traveled road running north from Moscow was not markedly so. He had no desire to raise a timid son.
"Take 5 men and 2 dozen candles. That should ensure your reception."
A light came into the boy's face. Pyotr's mouth tightened. Marina was bone in the unyielding earth. But he had seen her look just that way when her soul lit her face like firelight.
"Thank you, Father," the boy said.
He dashed out the door and away, lithe as a weasel. Pyotr heard him in the dvor before the palace, calling the men, calling for his horse.
"Marina," said Pyotr low, "thank you for my sons."
The Trinity Lavra had been carved out of the wilderness. Though the feet of passing pilgrims had beaten a path through the snowy forest, the trees still pressed close on either side, dwarfing the bell tower of the plain wooden church. Sasha was reminded of his own village at Lesnaya Zemlya. A sturdy palisade surrounded the monastery, which was composed mostly of small wooden buildings. The air smelled of smoke and baking bread. Oleg had ridden with him, the head of his attendants.
"We can't all go in," said Sasha, reining his horse.
Oleg nodded. The whole party dismounted, bits jingling.
"You and you," Oleg said. "Watch the road."
The men chosen settled beside the path, loosened the horses' girths, and began searching for firewood. The others passed between the 2 uprights of a narrow, unbarred gate. Great trees threw sooty shadows onto the raw wood of the little church. A slim man ducked out of a doorway, wiping floury hands. He was not very tall and not very old. His broad nose was set between large, liquid eyes, the green-brown of a forest pool. He wore the coarse robe of a monk, splattered with flour. Sasha knew him. The monk might have been wearing the rags of a beggar or the robes of a bishop, and Sasha would still have known him. The boy dropped to his knees in the snow. The monk pulled up short.
"What brings you here, my son?"
Sasha could barely bring himself to look up.
"I would ask your blessing, Batyushka," he managed.
The monk raised a brow.
"You needn't call me so. I am not ordained. We are all children of God."
"We brought candles for the altar," Sasha stammered, still on his knees. A thin, brown, work-hardened hand thrust itself under Sasha's elbow and raised him to his feet. The two were nearly of a height, though the boy was broader of shoulder and not yet full-grown, gangly as a colt.
"We kneel to God alone here," said the monk.
He studied Sasha's face a moment. "I am making the altar bread for services tonight," he added abruptly. "Come and help me." Sasha nodded, wordless, and waved his men off. The kitchen was rude and hot from the oven. The flour and water and salt lay to hand, to be mixed, kneaded, and baked in the ashes. The two worked in silence for a time, but it was an easy silence. Peace lay thick on that place. The monk's questions were so mild that the boy hardly noticed he was being questioned, but, a little clumsy with the unaccustomed task, he rolled out dough and related his history, his father's rank, his mother's death, their journey to Moscow.
"And you came here," the monk finished for him. "What are you seeking, my son?"
Sasha opened his mouth and closed it again.
I do not know," he admitted shamefaced. "Something."
To his surprise, the monk laughed.
"Do you wish to stay then?"
Sasha could only stare.
"It is a hard life we lead here," the monk went on more seriously. "You would build your own cell, plant your garden, bake your bread, aid your brothers as necessary. But there is peace here, peace beyond anything. I see you have felt it."
Seeing Sasha still dumbfounded, he said,
"Yes. Yes, many pilgrims come here, and many of them ask to stay. But we take only the seekers who do not know what they are looking for."
"Yes," Sasha said at last, slowly. "Yes, I would like to stay very much."
"Very well," said Sergei Radonezhsky, and turned back to his baking.
They pressed the horses hard on the road back to Moscow. Oleg mistrusted the fiery look on his young lord's face. He rode close to Sasha's stirrup and resolved to speak to Pyotr. But the young lord reached his father first. They rode into the city in the midst of the brief burning sunset, with the towers of church and palace silhouetted against a violet sky. Sasha left his horse steaming in the dvor and ran at once up the stairs to his father's rooms. He found both father and brother dressing.
"Well met, little brother," said Kolya when Sasha came in. "Have you done with churches yet?"
He threw Sasha a quick, tolerant glance and returned his attention to his clothes. Tongue between his lips, he settled the hat of black sable rakishly on his black hair.
"Well, you are in good time. Wash off the stink. We are feasting tonight, and it may be the family will show us the woman father is to marry. She has all her teeth. I have it on good authority. And a pleasant..." "What, Sasha?"
"Sergei Radonezhsky has asked me to join his monastery on Makovets Hill," repeated Sasha louder. Kolya looked blank. "I wish to be a monk," Sasha said.
That got their attention. Pyotr was drawing on his red-heeled boots. He slewed round to stare at his son and nearly tripped. Why? Cried Kolya in tones of deep horror. Sasha clamped his teeth on several uncharitable remarks. His brother had already cut a large swath through the palace serving women.
To dedicate my life to God, he informed Kolya, with a touch of superiority.
I see your holy man made quite an impression, Pyotr said, before the astonished Kolya had recovered.
He had regained his balance and was drawing his second boot on, with perhaps a bit more vim than necessary.
Yes, he did, Father.
Very well. You may, said Pyotr.
Kolya gaped. Pyotr put his foot down and stood. His caftan was ochre and rust. The gold rings on his hands caught the candlelight. His hair and beard had been combed with scented oil. He looked both imposing and uncomfortable. Sasha, who had been expecting a drawn-out battle, stared at his father.
On two conditions, Pyotr added.
What are they?
One, you may not visit this holy man again until you go to join his order. That will only be after next year's harvest, when you will have had a year to reflect. Two, you must remember that as a monk, your inheritance will go to your brothers, and you will have naught but your prayers to sustain you.
Sasha swallowed hard.
But, Father, if I might only see him again...
No!
Pyotr cut him off in a tone that brooked no argument.
You may turn monk if you will, but you will do it with your eyes open, not enthralled by the words of a hermit.
Sasha nodded reluctantly.
Very well, Father, he said.
Pyotr, his face a little grimmer than usual, turned without another word and strode down the stairs to where the horses waited, drowsing in the faded evening light. Chapter 6. Demons. Ivan Krasny had only one son, the small blonde wildcat Dmitry Ivanovich. Alexei, Metropolitan of Moscow, the highest prelate in Rus, ordained by the Patriarch of Constantinople himself, was charged with teaching the boy letters and statecraft. Some days, Alexei thought the job was beyond anyone short of a wonder worker. 3 hours already, the boys had labored over the birch bark. Dmitry with his elder cousin, Vladimir Andreevich, the young prince of Serpukhov. They scuffled, they spilled things.
Might as well ask the palace cats, thought Alexei, despairing, to sit and attend. Father, cried Dmitry. Father!
Ivan Ivanovich came through the door. Both boys sprang off their stools and bowed, pushing each other.
Get you gone, my sons, said Ivan. I would speak with the Holy Father.
The boys disappeared on the instant. Alexei sank into a chair by the oven and poured out a large measure of mead.
How is my son? Said Ivan,
drawing up the chair opposite. The prince and the Metropolitan had known each other a long time. Alexei had been loyal even before the death of Semyon assured Ivan the throne.
Bold, fair, charming, flighty as a butterfly, said Alexei. He will be a good prince if he lives so long. Why have you come to me, Ivan Ivanovich?
Anna, said Ivan succinctly.
The Metropolitan frowned.
Is she getting worse? No, but she'll never be any better. She is growing too old to lurk around the palace and make folk nervous.
Anna Ivanovna was the only child of Ivan's first marriage. The girl's mother was dead, and her stepmother hated the sight of her. The people muttered when she passed and crossed themselves. There are convents enough, returned Alexei. It is a simple matter.
No convent in Moscow, said Ivan. My wife won't have it. She says the girl will cause talk if she stays near. Madness is a shameful thing in a line of princes. She must be sent away.
I will arrange it if you like, said Alexei wearily.
Already he arranged many things for this prince.
She can go south, give an abbess enough gold, and she will take Anna and hide her lineage in the bargain.
My thanks, father, said Ivan,
and poured more wine.
However, I think you have a larger problem, added Alexei.
Numerous ones, said the Grand Prince, gulping his wine.
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
Which were you referring to?
The Metropolitan jerked his chin in the direction of the door, where the two princes had gone.
Young Vladimir Andreevich, he said, the Prince of Serpukhov. His family wants him married.
Ivan was unimpressed.
Plenty of time for that. He is only 13.
Alexei shook his head.
They have a princess of Litva in mind, the Duke's second daughter. Remember, Vladimir is also a grandson of Ivan Kalita, and he is older than your Dmitri. Well married and full grown, he would have a better claim to Moscow than your own son, should you die untimely.
Ivan grew pale with anger.
They dare not! I am the Grand Prince and Dmitri is my son!
And so, said Alexei unmoved, the Khan heeds the claims of princes only as long as they suit his ends. The strongest prince gets the patent. That is how the Horde assures peace in its territories.
Ivan reflected.
What then?
See Vladimir wed to another woman, said Alexei at once. Not a princess, but not one so low-born as to cause insult. If she is beautiful, the boy is young enough to swallow it.
Ivan reflected, sipping his wine and biting his fingers.
Pyotr Vladimirovich is lord of rich lands, he said at last. His daughter is my own niece, and she will have a great dowry. She cannot fail to be a beauty. My sister was very beautiful, and her mother charmed my father into marriage, though she came to Moscow a beggar.
Alexei's eyes sparked. He tugged his brown beard.
Yes, he said. I had heard that Pyotr Vladimirovich was in Moscow in search of a wife for himself as well. Yes, said Ivan. He surprised everyone. It is 7 years since my sister died. No one thought he would marry again.
Well then, said Alexei, if he is looking for a wife, what if you gave him your daughter?
Ivan put down his cup in some surprise.
Anna will be well hidden in the northern woods, Alexei continued. And will Vladimir Andreevich dare refuse Pyotr's daughter then? A girl so closely connected to the throne? It would be an insult to you.
Ivan frowned.
Anna wants, most particularly, to go to a convent.
Alexei shrugged.
And so? Pyotr Vladimirovich is not a cruel man. She will be happy enough.
Think of your son, Ivan Ivanovich.
A demon sat sewing in the corner, and she was the only one who saw. Anna Ivanovna clutched at the cross between her breasts. Eyes shut, she whispered,
"Go away, go away, please go away."
She opened her eyes. The demon was still there, but now two of her women were staring at her. Everyone else was looking with studied interest at the sewing in their laps. Anna tried not to let her eyes dart again to the corner, but she couldn't help it. The demon sat on its stool, oblivious. Anna shuddered. The heavy linen shirt lay on her lap like a dead thing. She thrust her hands into its sleek folds to hide her trembling. A serving woman slipped into the room. Anna hastily took up her needle and was surprised when the worn bast shoes stopped in front of her.
Anna Ivanovna, you are summoned to your father.
Anna stared. Her father had not summoned her for the better part of a year. She sat a moment bewildered, then jumped to her feet. Swiftly, she changed her plain sarafan to one of crimson and ochre, drawing it over her grimy skin, trying to ignore the stink of her long chestnut braid. The ruse liked to be clean. In winter, scarce a week went by when her half-sisters did not visit the bathhouses, but there was a little pot-bellied devil in there that grinned at them through the steam. Anna tried to point him out, but her sisters saw nothing. At first they took it for her imagination, later for foolishness, and at last just looked at her sideways and didn't say anything at all. So Anna had learned not to mention the eyes in the bathhouse, just as she never mentioned the bald creature sewing in the corner. But she would look sometimes. She couldn't help it. And she never went to the bathhouse unless her stepmother dragged or shamed her into it. Anna unraveled and replaited her greasy hair and touched the cross over her breast. She was the most devout of all her sisters. Everyone said so. What they didn't know was that in church there were only the unearthly faces of the icons. No demons haunted her there, and she'd have lived in a church if she could, shielded by incense and painted eyes. The oven was hot in her stepmother's workroom, and the Grand Prince stood beside it, sweating in winter finery. He wore his usual acerbic expression, though his eyes sparkled. His wife sat beside the fire, her thin plait straggling out from beneath her high headdress. Her needles lay forgotten in her lap. Anna halted a few paces away and bent her head. Husband and wife looked her over in silence. Finally, her father spoke to her stepmother.
"Glory of God, woman," he said, sounding annoyed. "Can you not get the girl to bathe? She looks as though she's been living with pigs."
"It doesn't matter," her mother replied, "if she is already promised."
Anna had been staring at her toes like a well-bred maiden, but now her head shot up.
"Promised?" she whispered,
hating the way her voice rose and squeaked.
"You are to be married," her father said, "to Pyotr Vladimirovich, one of those northern boyars. He's a rich man, and he will be kind to you."
"Married? But I thought, I hoped, I meant to go to a convent. I would pray for your soul, father. I wish that above all things."
Anna twisted her hands together.
"Nonsense," said Ivan, brisk. "You will like having sons, and Pyotr Vladimirovich is a good man. A convent is a cold place for a girl."
"Cold? No, a convent was safe. Safe, blessed, a respite from her madness."
Since she could remember, Anna had wanted to take vows. Now her skin blanched in terror. She flung herself forward and caught her father's feet.
"No, father," she cried. "No, please, I don't want to marry."
Ivan picked her up, not unkindly, and set her on her feet.
"Enough of that," he said. "I have decided, and it is for the best. You will be well dowered, of course, and you will make me strong grandsons."
Anna was small and scrawny, and her stepmother's expression indicated doubt on that score.
"But please," whispered Anna, "what is he like?"
"Ask your women," said Ivan indulgently. "I'm sure they'll have rumors. Wife, see that her things are in order, and for God's sake, make her bathe before the wedding."
Dismissed, Anna trudged back to her sewing, biting back sobs.
Married. Not to retreat, but to be the mistress of a lord's domain, not to be safe in a convent, but to live as some lord's breeding sow.
And the northern boyars were lusty men, the serving girl said, who dressed in skins and had hundreds of children. They were rough and warlike and, some like to say, spurned Christ and worshipped the devil. Anna pulled her pretty sarafan off over her head, shivering. If her sinful imagination conjured demons in the relative security of Moscow, what would it be like alone on the estate of a wild lord? The northern forests were haunted, the women said, and the winter lasted 8 months in 12. It did not bear thinking of. When the girl sat down again to her sewing, her hands trembled so that she could not set her stitches straight, and for all her efforts, the linen was blotched with silent tears. Chapter 7. The Meeting in the Marketplace. Pyotr Vladimirovich, unaware that his future had been agreed upon between the Grand Prince and the Metropolitan of Moscow, rose early the next morning and went to the market in Moscow's main square. His mouth tasted of old mushrooms, and his head throbbed with talk and drink. And,
foolish old man to let the boy run wild,
his son wished to turn monk. Pyotr had high hopes for Sasha. The boy was cooler-headed and cleverer than his older brother, better with horses, defter with weapons. Pyotr could imagine no greater waste than to have him disappear into a hovel, to cultivate a garden to the glory of God.
Well, he consoled himself, 15 is very young.
Sasha would come round. Piety was one thing, quite another to give up family and inheritance for deprivation and a cold bed. The din of many voices penetrated his reverie. Pyotr shook himself. The cold air reeked of horses and fires, soot and honey wine. Men with mugs dangling from their belts proclaimed the virtues of the latter beside their sticky barrels. The pasty sellers were out with their steaming trays, and the sellers of cloth and gems, wax and rare wood, honey and copper, worked bronze and golden trinkets, jostled for room. Their voices thundered up to fright the morning sun.
And Moscow has only a little market, Pyotr thought.
Sarai was the seat of the Khan. It was there the great merchants went to sell marvels to a court jaded by 300 years of plunder. Even the markets further south, in Vladimir, or west, in Novgorod, were bigger than the one in Moscow. But merchants still trickled north from Byzantium and further east, tempted by the prices their wares fetched among the barbarians, and tempted even more by the prices the princes paid in Tsargrad for furs from the north. Pyotr could not go home empty-handed. Olga's gift was easy enough. He bought her a headdress of pearl-strewn silk to glow against her dark hair. For his three sons, he bought daggers, short but heavy, with inlaid hilts. However, try as he might, he could find nothing to give Vasilisa. She was not a girl for trinkets, for beads, or headdresses. But he could not very well give her a dagger. Frowning, Pyotr persevered and was testing the heft of gold brooches when he caught sight of a strange man. Pyotr could not have said exactly what about this man was strange, except that he had a sort of stillness striking amid the bustle. His clothes were fit for a prince, his boots richly embroidered. A knife hung at his belt, white gems sparkling at the hilt. His black curls were uncovered, odd for any man, and more so as it was white winter, brilliant sky, and snow groaning underfoot. He was clean-shaven, something all but unheard of among the Rus, and Pyotr from a distance could not tell if he was old or young. Pyotr realized he was staring and turned away, but he was curious. The jewel merchant said confidingly,
"You are curious about that man. You are not alone. He comes sometimes to the market, but no one knows who his people are."
Pyotr was skeptical.
The merchant smirked. "Truly, gospodin, he is never seen in church, and the bishop wants him stoned for idolatry. But he is rich, and he always brings the most marvelous things to trade. So the prince keeps the church quiet, and the man comes and goes away again. Perhaps he is a devil."
This was tossed off, half laughing, but then the merchant frowned.
"Never once have I seen him in the springtime. Always, always he comes in winter, at the turning of the year."
Pyotr grunted. He himself was quite open to the possibility of devils, but he was not convinced that they would stroll about markets, summer or winter, dressed in princely raiment. He shook his head, indicated a bracelet, and said,
"This is rotten stuff. Already the silver is green round the edges."
The merchant protested, and the two settled to chaffering in earnest, forgetting all about the black-haired stranger. The stranger in question halted before a market stall, not more than 10 paces from where Pyotr stood. He ran thin fingers over a heap of silk brocade, His hands alone could tell him the quality of the wares. He paid only cursory attention to the cloth before him. His pale eyes flicked here and there about the crowded market. The cloth seller watched the stranger with a sort of obsequious wariness. The merchants knew him. A few thought he was one of them. He had brought marvels to Moscow before, weapons from Byzantium, porcelain light as morning air. The merchants remembered. But this time, the stranger had another purpose. Else he'd never have come south. He did not like cities, and it was a risk to cross the Volga. The flashing colors and voluptuous weight of the fabric suddenly seemed tedious, and after a moment, the stranger abandoned the cloth and strode across the square. His horse stood on the south side, chewing wisps of hay. A roomy old man stood at her head, pale and thin and oddly insubstantial, though the white mare was magnificent as a rearing mountain, and her harness was tooled and chased with silver. Men stared at her with admiration as they passed. She flicked her ears like a coquette, drawing a faint smile from her rider. But suddenly, a big man with cracked fingernails appeared out of the crowd and snatched the horse's rein. Her rider's face darkened. Though his pace did not quicken, there was no need. A cold wind rippled across the square. Men snatched for hats and loosened garments. The would-be thief flung himself into the mare's saddle and dug in his heels. But the mare did not move. Neither did her groom, oddly enough. He neither shouted nor raised a hand. He merely watched, an unreadable look in his sunken eyes. The thief lashed the mare's shoulder. She did not stir a hoof, only swished her tail. The thief hesitated a bewildered instant, and then it was too late. The mare's rider strode up and wrenched him out of the saddle. The thief might have screamed, but found his throat frozen. Gasping, he groped for the wooden cross at his throat. The other smiled without humor. "You have trespassed on what is mine. Do you think faith will save you?"
"Gosudar," the thief stammered. "I did not know. I thought..."
"That such as I do not walk in the places of men?"
"Well, I go where I will."
"Please," choked the thief. "Gosudar, I beg."
"Don't mule," said the stranger with cool humor, "and I will leave you a while to walk free in the sun. However..."
The quiet voice dropped lower, and the laughter drained out of it like water from a smashed cup.
"You are marked. You are mine. And one day I shall touch you again. You will die."
The thief choked out a sobbing breath, then found himself suddenly alone, a stinging like fire in his arm and throat. Already in the saddle, though no one had seen him mount, the stranger wheeled and sent his horse through the crush. The horse's groom bowed once and melted into the crowd. The mare was light and swift and sure. Her rider's anger quieted as he rode.
"The signs led me here," said the man to his horse. "Here to this stinking city when I should not have left my own lands."
He had been in Moscow a month already, searching, tireless, face after face.
"Well, signs are not infallible," he said. "The witch's daughter is hidden from me, and her child is long gone. The hour might have passed, the hour might never come."
The mare slanted an ear back at her rider. His lips firmed.
"No," he said. "Am I so easily defeated?"
The mare went on at a steady canter. The man shook his head. He was not yet beaten. He held the magic trembling in his throat, in the hollow of his hand, ready. His answer lay somewhere in this miserable wooden city, and he would find it. He turned the mare west, urging her into a long striding gallop. The coolness among the trees would clear his head. He was not defeated. Not yet. The reek of mead and dogs, dust and humanity, greeted the stranger when he arrived at the Grand Prince's feast. Ivan's boyars were big men used to battle and to carving life out of the land of frost. The stranger was not so large as even the smallest, but no one, not even the bravest or the drunkest, could meet his eyes, and no one offered him challenge. The stranger took a place at the high table and drank his honey wine unmolested. The silver embroidery on his caftan shone in the torchlight. One of the princess's waiting women sat beside him, gazing up through her long lashes. Lent was near and the feasting was raucous, but it is all the same here, thought the stranger, all these dim, busy faces. Sitting amid the din and the stink, he felt for the first time, not despair perhaps, but the beginning of resignation. It was then that a man walked into the hall with two grown boys. The three took places at the high table. The older man was quite ordinary, his clothes of good quality. His elder son swaggered, and the younger walked softly, his glance cool and grave, perfectly ordinary. And yet, the stranger's gaze shifted. With the three came a curling breath of wind, a wind out of the north. In the space between one breath and the next, the wind told him a tale of life and death together, of a child born with a failing year. "The blood holds, brother," he whispered. "She lives, and I was not mistaken." His face was triumphant. He returned to the table, though indeed he had never moved, and smiled with sudden delight into the eyes of the woman beside him. Pyotr had all but forgotten the stranger in the market, but when he came that night to the grand prince's table, he was quickly reminded, for the same stranger was sitting among the boyars, beside one of the princess's waiting women. She was staring up at him, her painted eyelids trembling like wounded birds. Pyotr, Sasha, and Kolya found themselves sitting to the left of the lady. Though she was one Kolya himself had been courting, she did not so much as glance in his direction. Furious, the young man neglected eating in favor of glaring, ignored, fingering his belt knife, likewise, and declaiming to his brother the beauties of a certain merchant's daughter, which the entranced lady did not hear. Sasha remained as expressionless as possible, as though feigning deafness would make the impious talk go away. There came a cough from behind. Pyotr looked up from this interesting scene to find a servant at his elbow. "The Grand Prince would speak to you." Pyotr frowned and nodded. He had barely seen his erstwhile brother-in-law since that first night. He had talked with innumerable dvoryanye, dispensed his bribes liberally, and had in return been assured that, so long as he paid tribute, he would go unmolested by the tax collectors. Furthermore, he was deep in negotiations for the hand of a modest, decent woman who would tend his household and mother his children. All was proceeding in order. So what could the prince want? Pyotr made his way along the table, catching the gleam of teeth in the firelight from the dogs at Ivan's feet. The prince was not slow in coming to the point.
"My young nephew, Vladimir Andreevich of Serpukhov, wishes to take your daughter to wife," he said.
Had the prince informed him that his nephew wished to become a minstrel and wander the streets playing a guzla, Pyotr could not have been more astonished. His eyes flicked sideways to the prince in question, who sat drinking, a few places down the table. Ivan's nephew was 13 years old, a boy on the cusp of manhood, loose-limbed and spotty. He was also the grandson of Ivan Kalita, the old grand prince. Surely he could aspire to a more exalted match. All the ambitious families at court were pushing their virgin daughters at him under the blithe assumption that one must eventually stick. Why waste the position on the daughter of a man, even a rich man, of modest lineage, a girl whom the boy had never seen, and who, moreover, lived at a considerable distance from Moscow? Oh! Pyotr shook off his surprise. Olga came from far away. Ivan would be wary of girls who came armed with tribes of relations. An alliance between great families tended to give the descendants royal ambitions.
Young Dmitri's claim was not much stronger than his cousin's, and Vladimir was 3 years older than the heir. Princes inherited at the Khan's pleasure. Pyotr's daughter would have a large dowry, but that was all. Ivan was doing his best to muzzle the Muscovite boyars to Pyotr's benefit. Pyotr was pleased.
"Ivan Ivanovich," he began.
But the prince was not finished.
"If you will yield up your daughter to my cousin, I am prepared to give you my own daughter, Anna Ivanovna, in marriage. She is a fine girl, yielding as a dove, and can surely give you more sons."
Pyotr was startled for the second time and somewhat less pleased. He had 3 boys already, among whom he must divide his property, and was in no need of more. Why would the prince waste a virginal daughter on a man of no enormous consequence who wanted only a woman of sense to run his house? The prince raised an eyebrow. Still, Pyotr hesitated. Well, she was Marina's niece, a grand prince's daughter, cousin to his own children, and he could not very well ask what was wrong with her. Even if she were diseased, a drunkard, or a harlot, or... well, even so, the benefit of accepting the match would be considerable.
"How could I refuse, Ivan Ivanovich?" Pyotr said.
The prince nodded gravely.
"A man will come to you tomorrow to negotiate the bridal contract," he said, turning back to his goblet and his dogs.
Pyotr, dismissed, was left to make his way back to his place at the long table and tell his sons the news. He found Kolya sulking into his cup. The dark-haired stranger had left, and the woman was staring in the direction he had gone, with a look of such terror and agonized longing on her pale face that Pyotr, for all his troubles, found his hand darting almost involuntarily for the sword he was not wearing. Chapter 8. The Word of Pyotr Vladimirovich. Pyotr Vladimirovich took his bride's cold hand, squinted at her small, clenched face, and wondered if he could have been mistaken. It had taken a headlong week to negotiate the details of his marriage, so that it might be celebrated before Lent began. Kolya had spent the interval dallying with half the serving women in the Kremlin, looking for word on his father's prospective bride. Consensus eluded him. Some said she was pretty. Others said that she had a wart on her chin and only half her teeth. They said that her father kept her locked up or that she hid in her rooms and never came out. They said she was ill or mad or sorrowful or merely timid. And at last Pyotr decided that whatever the problem was, it was worse than he had feared. But now, facing his unveiled bride, he wondered. She was very small, about the same age as Kolya, though her demeanor made her seem younger. Her voice was soft and breathless, her manner submissive, her lips pleasingly full. There was nothing in her of Marina, though they had the same grandfather, and for that Pyotr was grateful. A warm chestnut braid framed her round face. Seen up close, there was also a suggestion of tightness about her eyes, as though her face would fall into lines like a closed fist as she got older. She wore a cross that she fingered constantly, and she kept her eyes lowered, even when Pyotr sought to look her in the face. Try as he might, Pyotr could not see anything manifestly wrong with her, except perhaps incipient ill temper. She certainly did not seem drunk or leprous or mad. Perhaps the girl was just shy and retiring. Perhaps the prince really did propose this marriage as a mark of favor. Pyotr touched the sweet outline of his bride's lips and wished he could believe it. They feasted in her father's hall after the wedding. The table groaned under the weight of fish and bread, pie and cheeses. Pyotr's men shouted and sang and drank his health. The grand prince and his family smiled, more or less sincerely, and wished them many children. Kolya and Sasha said little and looked with some resentment at their new stepmother,
a cousin scarce older than they. Pyotr plied his wife with mead and tried to set her at ease. He did his best not to think of Marina, 16 when he married her, who had stared him full in the face as she said her vows and laughed and sung and eaten heartily at her wedding feast, tossing him sidewise glances as though daring him to frighten her. Pyotr had taken her to bed half-crazed with desire and kissed her until defiance turned to passion. They had risen the next morning drunk with languor and shared delight. But this creature did not seem capable of defiance, perhaps not even of passion. She drooped under her headdress, answering his questions in monosyllables and shredding a bit of bread in her fingers. Finally, Pyotr turned away from her, sighing, and let his thoughts race along the winding track through the winter dark forest to the snows of Lesnaya Zemlya and the simplicities of hunting and mending away from the city of smiling enemies and barbed favors. 6 weeks later, Pyotr and his retinue prepared to take their leave. The days were lengthening and the snow in the capital had begun to soften. Pyotr and his sons eyed the snow and hastened their preparations. If the ice thinned before they crossed the Volga, they must exchange their sledges for wagons and wait an eternity before the river was passable by raft. Pyotr was worried for his lands and eager to get back to his hunting and husbandry. He also thought, vaguely, that the clean northern air might calm whatever was frightening his wife. Anna, though quiet and compliant, never stopped gazing around her, wide-eyed, fingering the cross between her breasts. Sometimes she muttered disconcertingly into empty corners. Pyotr had taken her to bed every night since their wedding, more for duty than for pleasure, true, but she had yet to look him in the face. He heard her weeping when she thought he slept. The party's numbers had increased significantly with the addition of Anna Ivanovna's belongings and retinue. Their sledges filled the courtyard, and many of the servants had pack horses on leading reins. Both Pyotr's sons were mounted. Sasha's mare picked up one foot, then another, and flung her dark head. Kolya's horse stood still, and Kolya himself drooped in the saddle. Bloodshot eyes slitted against the morning sun. Kolya had known great success among the boyar sons in Moscow. He'd bested them all at wrestling, and many of them at archery. He had drunk nearly all of them under the table, and he had dallied with any number of palace women. He had, in short, enjoyed himself, and he was not relishing the prospect of a long journey, with nothing but hard labor at the end of it. For his part, Pyotr was satisfied with her expedition. Olga was betrothed to a man, well, boy, of far more consequence than he would have dreamed. He himself had remarried, and if the lady was rather strange, at least she was not promiscuous or diseased, and she was another grand prince's daughter. So it was with high good humor that Pyotr saw all in readiness for their departure. He looked around for his gray stallion, that they might mount and be gone. A stranger was standing at his horse's head, the man from the market, who had also supped in the grand prince's hall. Pyotr had forgotten the stranger in the haste surrounding his wedding, but now there he was, stroking Buran's nose and looking at the stallion appraisingly. Pyotr waited, not without a certain anticipation, for the stranger to have his hand bitten off, for Buran did not suffer familiarities. But after a moment, he realized with astonishment that the horse was standing perfectly still, ears drooping, like a peasant's old donkey. Baffled and annoyed, Pyotr took a long step toward them, but Kolya was before him. The boy had found a target upon which to vent his wrath, headache, and general dissatisfaction. Spurring his gelding, he pulled up not more than a long step away from the stranger, near enough for his horse's hooves to splatter filthy snow all over the man's blue robe. The gelding curveted, eyes rolling. A sweat broke out on its brown flanks. "What are you doing here?" Kolya demanded, curbing the gelding with hard hands.
How dare you touch my father's horse?
The stranger wiped a splatter off one cheek.
He is a very fine horse, he replied, tranquil. I thought to buy him. Well, you can't.
Kolya sprang to the ground. Pyotr's eldest son was as broad and heavily built as a Siberian ox. The other, who was both shorter and more slender, ought to have looked frail beside him, but he didn't. Perhaps it was the look in his eyes. With a thrill of unease, Pyotr quickened his pace. Kolya was maybe still drunk, maybe just unwary, but he mistook the stranger's mildness for yielding.
And how do you propose to manage a horse like that, little man? He added scornfully. Run back to your lover and leave riding war horses to men of strength.
He pressed forward until the two were nose to nose, fingering his dagger. The stranger smiled with a wry, self-deprecating twist of the lips. Pyotr wanted to shout a warning, but the words froze in his throat. For a moment, the stranger was perfectly still. And then he moved. At least, Pyotr assumed that he moved. He did not see it. He saw nothing but a flicker, like light on a bird's wing. Kolya cried out, clutching his wrist, and then the man stood behind him, an arm around his neck, and a dagger pressed to his throat. It had happened so fast even the horses hadn't had time to startle. Pyotr sprang forward, hand on his sword, but stopped when the man looked up. The stranger had the oddest eyes Pyotr had ever seen, a pale, pale blue, like a clear sky on a cold day. His hands were supple and steady.
Your son has insulted me, Pyotr Vladimirovich, he said. Shall I demand his life?
The knife moved, just the tiniest motion. A thin line of red opened on Kolya's neck, soaking his new beard. The boy drew a sobbing breath. Pyotr did not spare him a glance.
It is your right, he said, but I beg you, allow my son to make amends.
The man threw Kolya a scornful glance.
A drunken boy, he said, and tightened his hand again on the knife. No, rasped Pyotr. Perhaps I might make amends. We have some gold, or, if you wish, my horse.
Pyotr did his best not to glance at his beautiful gray stallion. A faint, very faint amusement appeared in the stranger's frozen eyes.
Generous, he said dryly, but no. I will give you your son's life, Pyotr Vladimirovich, in exchange for a service. What service? Have you daughters?
That was unexpected.
Yes,
Pyotr answered warily, but
the stranger's look of amusement deepened. No, I will not take one as a concubine or ravish her in a snowbank. You are bringing gifts for your children, are you not?
Well, I have a gift for your younger daughter. You shall make her swear to keep it by her always. You shall also swear never to recount to any living soul the circumstances of our meeting.
Under these, and only these, conditions will I spare your son his life.
Pyotr considered for an instant.
A gift? What gift must be given with threats to my son? I will not put my daughter in danger, he said, even for my son. Vasya is only a little girl child, my wife's last born.
But he swallowed hard. Kolya's blood was seeping down in a slow, scarlet stream. The man looked at Pyotr through narrowed eyes, and for a long moment there was silence. Then the stranger said,
No harm will come to her, I swear it, on the ice and the snow and a thousand lives of men. What is this gift, then? Said Pyotr.
The stranger let go of Kolya, who stood like a sleepwalker, his eyes curiously blank. The stranger strode over to Pyotr and withdrew an object from a belt pouch. In his wildest imaginings, never would Pyotr have dreamed of the bauble the man held out to him, a single jewel of a brilliant silver blue, nestled in tangle of pale metal, like a star or a snowflake, and dangling from a chain as fine as silk thread. Pyotr looked up, questions on his lips, but the stranger forestalled him.
There it is, he said. A trinket, no more.
Now, your promise. You will give that to your daughter, and you will tell no one of our meeting. If you break your word, I shall come and kill your son.
Pyotr looked to his men. They stood blank-eyed. Even Sasha on his horse nodded a heavy head. Pyotr's blood chilled. He feared no man. But this uncanny stranger had bewitched his folk. Even his brave sons stood helpless. The necklace hung icy cold and heavy in his hand.
I swear it, Pyotr said in his turn.
The man nodded once, turned, and strode away across the muddy yard. As soon as he was out of sight, Pyotr's men stirred around him. Pyotr hastily thrust the shining object into his belt pouch.
Father, said Kolya. Father, what is wrong? Everything is ready. It wants only your word, and we shall go.
Pyotr, staring incredulously at his son, was silent, for the bloodstains had gone, and Kolya blinked at him with a placid, bloodshot gaze, unclouded by his recent encounter.
But,
he began and then hesitated, remembering his promise.
Father, what is wrong?
Nothing, said Pyotr.
He strode over to Buran, mounted, and urged the horse forward, resolving to put the strange meeting out of his mind. But two circumstances conspired against him. For one, when they made camp that night, Kolya found 5 white oblong marks on his throat, as though he had taken frostbite, though his beard was heavy, his throat well wrapped. For another, listen as he might, Pyotr heard not a single word of discussion among his servants about the strange events in the courtyard, and was forced reluctantly to conclude that he was the only one who remembered them at all. Chapter 9. The Madwoman in the Church. The road home seemed longer than it had when they set out. Anna was unused to travel, and they went at little more than foot pace, with frequent halts for rest. Despite their slowness, the journey was not as tedious as it might have been. They had left Moscow heavy laden with provisions, and took also the hospitality of villages and boyars' houses as they came upon them. Once they were out of the city, Pyotr went to his wife's bed with renewed eagerness, remembering her soft mouth and the silky grip of her young body. But each time she met him, not with anger or laments, which he might have managed, but with baffling, silent weeping, tears sliding down her round cheeks. A week of this drove Pyotr away, half angry and half bewildered. He began to range further during the day, hunting on foot or taking Buran deep into the woods, until man and horse returned scratched and weary, and Pyotr was tired enough to think only of his bed. Even sleep was no respite, though, for in his dreams he saw a sapphire necklace and spidery white fingers against the neck of his firstborn. He would wake in the dark calling for Kolya to run. He itched to be home, but they could not hurry. For all his efforts, Anna grew pale and feeble with journeying, and would beg them to halt earlier and earlier in the day to set up tents and braziers, that the servants might serve her hot soup and warm her numb hands. But they crossed the river at last. When Pyotr judged the party less than a day away from Lesnaya Zemlya, he set Buran's feet on the snowy track and gave the stallion his head. The bulk of his men would follow with the sledges, but he and Kolya flew home like wind-blown ghosts. It was with inexpressible relief that Pyotr broke from the cover of the trees and saw his own house standing silvery and unharmed in the clear winter daylight. Every day since Pyotr and Sasha and Kolya had gone away, Vasya had slipped from the house whenever she could contrive it and run to climb her favorite tree, the one that stretched a great limb over the road to the south of Lesnaya Zemlya.
Alyosha went with her sometimes, but he was heavier than she, and a clumsier climber. So Vasya was alone on the day she saw the flashing of hooves and harness. She slid down her tree like a cat and bolted on her short legs. By the time she reached the palisade gate, she was shouting, "Father! Father! It is father!" By then it was no great news, for the two riders, coming on much faster than one small girl, were already crossing the fields at a great pace, and the villagers, from their little rise, could see them plainly. The people looked at each other, wondering where the others were, fearing for their kin. And then Pyotr and Kolya, Sasha had stayed with the sledges, swept into the village and reined their stamping horses. Dunya attempted to seize Vasya, who had stolen Alyosha's clothes to climb her tree and was grubby to boot. But Vasya wriggled away and ran into the dooryard. "Father!" she cried. "Kolya!" and laughed when each caught her up in turn. "Father, you are back!"
"I have brought a mother for you, Vasochka," said Pyotr, looking her over with a raised eyebrow.
She was covered in bits of tree.
"Though I did not tell her she was getting a wood sprite instead of a little girl."
But he kissed her grubby cheek, and she giggled.
"Oh, then where is Sasha?"
cried Vasya, looking about her in sudden fear.
"Where are the sledge horses?"
"Never fear, they are on the road behind us," said Pyotr,
and he added louder, so all the assembled people could hear.
"They will be here before nightfall. We must be ready to receive them. And you," he added lower to Vasya, "get you into the kitchen and bid Dunya dress you. All else equal, I'd rather present a daughter to her stepmother and not a wood sprite."
He put her down with a little push, and Olga hauled her sister into the kitchen. The sledges came with a westering sun. They made their weary way over the fields and up through the village gate. The people cheered and exclaimed at the fine closed sleigh that contained the new wife of Pyotr Vladimirovich. Most of the village assembled to see her. Anna Ivanovna came out of the sleigh tottering, stiff, pale as ice. Vasya thought she looked scarcely older than Olya, and not nearly so old as her father.
"Well, all the better," the child thought. "Perhaps she will play with me."
She smiled her best smile, but Anna did not answer by word or sign. She cringed at all the stares, and Pyotr remembered belatedly that women in Moscow lived apart from the men. "I am tired," Anna Ivanovna whispered, and crept into the house, clinging to Olga's arm. The people looked at each other nonplussed.
"Well, it was a long journey," they said at last. "She will be well in time. She is a grand prince's daughter, as Marina Ivanovna was."
And they were proud that such a woman had come to live among them. They returned to their huts to build up their fires against the dark and eat their watery soup. But in the house of Pyotr Vladimirovich, they all feasted as best they could with Lent upon them and winter grown old and bony. They made decent shrift of it with fish and porridge. Afterward, Pyotr and his sons told the tale of their journey while Alyosha leaped about, threatening the fingers of servants with a splendid new dagger. Pyotr himself set the headdress on Olga's black hair and said, "I hope you will wear it on your wedding day, Olya." Olga blushed and paled, while Vasya, wordless, turned her vast eyes onto her father. Pyotr raised his voice so the room at large could hear.
"She will be the princess of Serpuhov," he said. "The grand prince himself betrothed her."
And he kissed his daughter. Olga smiled with half-frightened delight. In the tumult of congratulation, Vasya's thin, forlorn cry went unheard. But the feast wound down, and Anna sought her bed early. Olga went to help her, and Vasya trotted after. Slowly the kitchen emptied. Dusk deepened to night. The fire crumbled on a glowing core, and the air in the kitchen chilled and sank. At last, the winter kitchen was empty but for Pyotr and Dunya. The old lady sat weeping in her place near the fire.
"I knew it must come, Pyotr Vladimirovich," she said.
and if ever there was a girl who ought to be a princess, it is my Olya. But it is a hard thing. She will live in a palace in Moscow, like her grandmother, and I will never see her again. I am too old for journeys." Pyotr sat before the fire, fingering the jewel in his pocket. "It comes to all women," he said. Dunya said nothing.
"Here, Dunyashka," said Pyotr, and his voice was so strange that the old nurse turned quickly to look at him. "I have a gift for Vasya."
He had already given her a length of fine green cloth to make a good sarafan. Dunya frowned.
"Another Pyotr Vladimirovich," she said. "She will be spoiled." "Even so," said Pyotr.
Dunya squinted at him in the dark, puzzled by the look on his face. Pyotr thrust the necklace at Dunya, as though eager to be rid of it.
"Give it to her yourself. You must see she keeps it always by her. Make her promise, Dunya."
Dunya looked more puzzled than ever, but she took the cold blue thing and squinted at it. Pyotr frowned more terribly than ever. He reached out as though to take it back, but his fist closed on itself and the motion died unfinished. Abruptly, he turned on his heel and sought his bed. Dunya, alone in the dim kitchen, stared down at the pendant. She turned it this way and that, muttering to herself.
"Well, Pyotr Vladimirovich," she murmured, "and where in Moscow does a man get such a jewel?"
Shaking her head, Dunya slipped it into her pocket, resolving to keep it safe until the little girl was old enough to be trusted with the glittering thing. 3 nights later, the old nurse dreamed. In her dream, she was a maiden again, walking alone in the winter woods. The bright sound of sleigh bells rang out on the road. She loved sledging and spun to see a white horse trotting toward her. Its driver was a man with black hair. He did not slow when he came up alongside, but caught her arm and pulled her roughly onto the sledge. His gaze did not leave the white road. Air like the iciest of January blasts eddied around him despite the winter sunshine. Dunya was suddenly afraid.
"You have taken something that was not given to you," he said.
Dunya shuddered at the whine of storm winds in his voice.
"Why?"
Her teeth were chattering so hard she could barely form words, and the man whirled on her in a blaze of thin winter light.
"That necklace was not meant for you," he hissed. "Why have you taken it?" "Her father brought it for Vasilisa, but she's only a child. I saw it, and I knew it was a talisman," stammered Dunya. "I have not stolen it, I have not. But I am afraid for the girl. Please, she is too young for sorcery or the favor of the old gods."
The man laughed. Dunya heard a grinding bitterness in the sound.
"Gods? There is but one god now, child, and I am no more than a wind through bare branches."
He was silent, and Dunya, trembling, tasted blood where she'd bitten into her lip. At last he nodded.
"Very well. Keep it for her then, until she is grown, but no longer. I think I need not tell you what will happen if you play me false."
Dunya found herself nodding vigorously, shaking harder than ever. The man cracked his whip. The horse raced off, running ever faster over the snow. Dunya felt her grip on the seat slipping. Frantically, she clutched at it, but she was falling. Falling over backward. She woke with a gasp on her own pallet in the kitchen. She lay in the dark, shivering, and it was a long time before she could get warm. Anna came reluctantly awake, blinking dreams from her eyes. It had been a pleasant dream, the last. There had been warm bread in it and someone with a soft voice. But even as she reached for it, the dream slipped away, and she was left empty, clutching blankets around her to ward off the dawn chill. She heard a rustling and craned her head around. A demon sat on her own stool,
mending one of Pyotr's shirts. The gray light of a winter morning threw bars of shadow over the gnarled thing. She shuddered. Her husband snored beside her, oblivious, and Anna tried to ignore the specter, as she had every day in the seven since she first awoke in this horrible place. She turned away and burrowed into the coverlet, but she could not get warm. Her husband had thrown off the blanket, but she was always cold here. When she asked that the fire be built up, the serving women just stared at her, politely perplexed. She thought about creeping closer, to share her husband's warmth, but he might decide he wanted her again. Though he tried to be gentle, he was insistent, and most of the time she wanted to be left alone. She risked a look back at the stool. The thing was staring straight at her. Anna could stand it no more. She slipped to the floor, pulling on garments at random, and wrapped a scarf round her half-raveled braids. Darting through the kitchen and out the kitchen door, she earned a startled look from Dunya, who always rose early to set the bread baking. The gray morning light was giving way to rose. The ground glittered as though gem-studded, but Anna didn't notice the snow. All she saw was a little wooden church not 20 paces from the house. Heedless, she ran toward it, yanked open the door, and slid inside. She wanted to weep, but she clenched her teeth and her fists and silenced her tears. She did altogether too much weeping. Her madness was worse here in the north, far, far worse. Pyotr's house was alive with devils, a creature with eyes like coals hid in the oven. A little man in the bathhouse winked at her through the steam. A demon like a heap of sticks slouched around the dooryard. In Moscow, her devils had never looked at her, never spared her a glance, but here they were always staring. Some even came quite close, as though they would speak, and each time Anna had to flee, hating the puzzled stares of her husband and stepchildren. She saw them all the time, everywhere, except here in the church, the blessed, quiet church. It was nothing, really, compared to the churches in Moscow. There was no gold or gilt, and only one priest to give service. The icons were small and ill-painted. But here, she saw nothing but floor and walls and icons and candles. There were no faces in the shadows. She stayed and stayed, by turns praying and staring into space. It was well past dawn when she crept back to the house. The kitchen was crowded, the fire roaring. The baking and stewing and cleaning and drying went on without cease, from dark to dark. The women did not react when Anna crept in. No one so much as turned her head. Anna took that, above all, as a comment on her weakness. Olga looked up first. "Would you like some bread, Anna Ivanovna?" she asked. Olga could not like the poor creature that had taken her mother's place, though she was a kind girl and pitied her. Anna was hungry, but there was a tiny, grizzled creature sitting just inside the mouth of the oven. Its beard glowed with the heat as it gnawed a blackened crust. Anna Ivanovna's mouth worked, but she could make no answer. The little creature looked up from its bread and cocked its head. There was curiosity in its bright eyes. "No," Anna whispered. "No, I don't want any bread." She turned and fled to the dubious safety of her own room, while the women in the kitchen looked at each other and slowly shook their heads. Chapter 10. The Princess of Serpukhov. The following autumn, Kolya was married to the daughter of a neighboring boyar. She was a fat, strapping, yellow-haired girl, and Pyotr built them a little house of their own with a good clay oven. But it was the great wedding the people awaited, when Olga Petrovna would become the Princess of Serpukhov. That had taken almost a year to negotiate. The gifts began coming from Moscow before the mud closed the roads, but the details took longer. The way from Lesnaya Zemlya to Moscow was a hard one. Messengers were delayed or disappeared. They broke their skulls, were robbed, or lamed their horses. But it was settled at last. the young prince of Serpukhov was to come himself, with his retinue, to marry Olga and take her back to his house in Moscow.
"It is better for her to be married before she travels," said the messenger. "She will not be so frightened."
And, the messenger might have added, Alexei, Metropolitan of Moscow, wanted the marriage accomplished and consummated before Olga came to the city. The prince arrived just as pale spring became dazzling summer, with a tender, capricious sky, and the fading flowers buried in a wash of summer grass. A year had ripened him. The spots had faded, though he was still no beauty, and he hid his shyness with boisterous good temper. With the prince of Serpukhov came his cousin, the blonde Dmitri Ivanovich, calling out greetings. The princes had come with hawks and hounds and horses, with women in carved wooden carts, and they brought many gifts. The boys came also with a guardian, a clear-eyed monk, not very old, silent more often than speaking. The cavalcade raised a great noise and dust and clamor. The whole village came to gawk, and many to offer the hospitality of their huts to the men and pasture for the weary horses. The boy prince Vladimir shyly slipped a sparkling green barrel onto Olga's finger, and the whole house gave itself to mirth as it had not since Marina breathed her last.
"The boy is kind, at least," said Dunya to Olga in a rare quiet moment.
They sat together beside the wide window in the summer kitchen. Vasya sat at Olga's feet, listening and poking at her mending.
"Yes," said Olga, "and Sasha is coming with me to Moscow. He will see me to my husband's house before he joins his monastery. He has promised."
The barrel ring blazed on her finger. Her betrothed had also hung her throat with raw amber and given her a bolt of marvelous cloth, fiery as poppies. Dunya was hemming it for a sarafan. Vasya was only pretending to sew. Her small hands were clenched in her lap.
"You will do very well," said Dunya firmly, biting the end of a thread. "Vladimir Andreevich is rich and young enough to take the advice of his wife. It was generous of him to come and marry you here, in your own house."
"He came because the Metropolitan made him," Olga interjected.
"And he stands high in the Grand Prince's favor. He is young Dmitri's dearest friend, that is plain. He will have a high place when Ivan Krasny is dead. You will be a great lady. You could not do better, my Olya."
"Yes," said Olga again slowly.
At her feet, Vasya's dark head drooped. Olga bent to stroke her sister's hair.
"I suppose he is kind, but I..."
Dunya smiled sardonically.
"Were you hoping that the raven prince would come, like the bird in the fairy tale that came for Prince Ivan's sister?"
Olga blushed and laughed, but she did not reply. Instead, she picked up Vasilisa, though she was a great girl to be held like a child, and rocked her back and forth. Vasya curled rigid in her sister's arms.
"Hush, little frog," said Olga, as though Vasya were a baby. "It will be all right."
"Olga Petrovna," said Dunya, "my Olya, fairy tales are for children, but you are a woman, and soon you'll be a wife. To wed a decent man and be safe in his house, to worship God and bear strong sons, that is real and right. It is time to put aside dreaming. Fairy tales are sweet on winter nights, nothing more."
Dunya thought suddenly of pale, cold eyes and an even colder hand.
"Very well. Until she is grown, but no longer."
She shivered and added lower, looking at Vasya.
"Even the maidens of fairy tales do not always end happily. Alyanushka was turned into a duck and watched the wicked witch butcher her duck children."
And seeing Olga still downcast, smoothing Vasya's hair, she added a little harshly,
"Child, it is the lot of women. I do not think you wish to be a nun. You might grow to love him. Your mother did not know Pyotr Vladimirovich before her wedding, and I remember her afraid, though your mother was brave enough to face down Baba Yaga herself. But they loved each other from the first night.
Mother is dead, said Olga in a flat voice. Another has her place, and I am going away forever.
Against her shoulder, Vasya let out a muffled wail.
She will never die, retorted Dunya firmly, because you are alive, and you are as beautiful as she was, and you will be the mother of princes. Be brave. Moscow is a fair city, and your brothers will come to see you.
That night, Vasya came to bed with Olga and said urgently, Don't go, Olya. I'll never be bad again. I'll never even climb trees. She looked up at her sister, owl-like and trembling. Olga could not forbear a laugh, though it broke a little at the end. I must, little frog, she said. He is a prince, and he is rich and kind, as Dunya says. I must marry him or go to a convent, and I want children of my own. 10 little frogs, just like you. But you have me, Olya, Vasya said.
Olya pulled her close.
But you will grow up yourself one day and not be a child anymore. And what use will you have then for your tottering old sister?
Always!
Vasya burst out passionately.
Always! Let's run away and live in the woods.
I'm not sure you'd like to live in the woods, said Olga. Baba Yaga might eat us.
No,
said Vasya with perfect assurance.
There is only the one-eyed man. If we stay away from the oak tree, he will never find us.
Olya did not know what to make of this.
We will have an izba among the trees, said Vasya, and I will bring you nuts and mushrooms.
I have a better idea, said Olya.
You are a great girl already, and it will not be too many years before you are a woman. I will send for you from Moscow when you are grown. We will be 2 princesses in a palace together, and you will have a prince for yourself. How would you like that?
But I am grown now, Olya,
cried Vasya immediately, swallowing her tears and sitting up.
Look, I am much bigger.
Not yet, I think, little sister, said Olga gently. But be patient and mind Dunya and eat plenty of porridge. When father says you are grown, then will I send for you.
I will ask father, said Vasya confidently. Perhaps he will say I am grown already.
Sasha had recognized the monk the moment he strode into the yard. In the confusion of welcome and bride gifts, with a feast in the making among the green summer birches, he ran forward, seized the monk's hand, and kissed it.
Father, you came, he said.
As you see, my son, said the monk, smiling. But it is so far.
Indeed not. When I was younger, I wandered the length and breadth of Rus, and the word was my path and my shield, my bread and my salt. Now I am old, and I stay in the Lavra. But the world is fair to me still, especially the north of the world in summertime. I am glad to see you.
What he did not say, at least not then, was that the grand prince was ill, and that Vladimir Andreevich's marriage was all the more urgent in consequence. Dmitri was barely 11, freckled and spoiled. His mother kept him in her sight and slept beside his bed. Small heirs of princes were wont to disappear when their fathers died untimely. That spring, Alexei had summoned the holy man, Sergei Radonezhsky, to his palace in the Kremlin. Sergei and Alexei had known each other a long time.
I am sending Vladimir Andreevich north to be married, Alexei had said, as soon as may be. He must be wed before Ivan dies. Young Dmitri will go with the bridal party. It will keep him out of harm's way. His mother fears for the child's life if he remains in Moscow.
The hermit and the metropolitan were drinking honey wine, much watered. They sat together on a wooden seat in the kitchen garden.
Is Ivan Ivanovich so very ill then? Said Sergei. He is gray and yellow together. He sweats and stinks, and his eyes are filmy, said the metropolitan. God willing, he lives, but I will be ready if he does not. I cannot leave the city.
Dmitri is so young. I would ask you to go with the bridal party to watch over him and see Vladimir wed.
Vladimir is to marry Pyotr Vladimirovich's daughter, is he not? Said Sergei.
I have met Pyotr's son. Sasha, they call him. He came to me at the Lavra. Such eyes as I have never seen. He will be a monk or a saint or a hero. A year ago he wished to take vows. Would that he still does. The Lavra could use a brother like that.
Well, go and see, said Alexei. Persuade Pyotr's son to come back to the Lavra with you. Dmitri must live in your monastery for his minority. All the better if he has Alexander Petrovich, a man of his blood, one dedicated to God, to be his companion. If Dmitri is crowned, he will want every ally ingenuity can yield him.
So will you, said Sergei.
The bees droned about them. The northern flowers made up in heady scents for their brief doomed days.
Hesitantly, Sergei added, will you be his regent then? Regents do not live long either, if their boy princes are slain.
Am I such a faint heart that I would not put myself between that boy and assassins? Said Alexei. I would, though it cost me my life. God is with us, but you must be metropolitan when I die.
Sergei laughed.
I will see the face of God and be blinded by glory before I come to Moscow to try and manage your bishop's brother. But I will go north with the Prince of Serpukhov. It is long since I traveled, and I would see the high forests again.
Pyotr saw the monk among the riders, and his face grew grim. But he spoke only courtesies until the evening after their arrival. That night, they all feasted together in the twilight, and when the laughter and torches of full-fed people slipped away toward the village, Pyotr came in the dusk and caught Sergei by the shoulder. The two faced each other beside the running stream.
And so you came, man of God, to steal my son from me? Pyotr said to Sergei. Your son is not a horse to be stolen.
No, snapped Pyotr, he is worse. A horse will listen to reason.
He is a warrior born, and a man of God, said Sergei.
His voice was mild as ever, and Pyotr's anger burned hotter, so that he choked on his words and said nothing. The monk frowned as though making a decision. Then he said,
Listen, Pyotr Vladimirovich, Ivan Ivanovich is dying. By now, perhaps he is dead.
This Pyotr had not known. He started and drew back.
His son Dmitri is a guest in your house, Sergei continued. When the boy leaves here, he will go straight to my own monastery, there to be hidden. There are claimants to the throne for whom the life of one small boy is as nothing. A prince needs men of his own blood to teach him and to guard him. Your son is Dmitri's cousin.
Pyotr was silent in his surprise. The bats were coming out. In his youth, Pyotr's nights had been full of their cries, but now they flittered silent as the encroaching dusk.
We do not just bake altar bread and chant, my folk and I, added Sergei. You are safe here, in this forest that could swallow an army, but there are few who can say as much. We bake our bread for the hungry and wield swords in their defense. It is a noble calling.
My son will wield a sword for his family, serpent, snapped Pyotr reflexively, angrier now because he was uncertain.
Indeed he will, said Sergei, for his own cousin, a boy that will one day have all Moscovy in his charge.
Pyotr again was silent, but his anger was broken. Sergei saw Pyotr's grief and bowed his head.
I am sorry, he said.
It is a hard thing. I will pray for you. He slipped away between the trees, the sound of his going swallowed by the stream. Pyotr did not stir. There was a full moon. The edge of its silver disk rose over the treetops.
You would have known what to say, he whispered. For myself, I do not. Help me, Marina. Even for the grand prince's heir, I would not lose my son.
I was angry when I heard you had sold my sister so far away, said Sasha to his father. He spoke rather jerkily. He was training a young horse.
Pyotr rode Buran, and the gray stallion, no plow horse, was looking with some wonder at the young beast curveting beside him. But Vladimir is a decent enough man, though he is so young. He is kind to his horses. I am glad of it for Olya's sake, but even if he was a drunken lecher and old to boot, I could do nothing else, said Pyotr. The grand prince did not ask.
Sasha thought suddenly of his stepmother, a woman that his father would never have chosen, with her easy tears, her praying, her starts and terrors.
You could not choose either, father, he said. I must be old, Pyotr thought to himself, if my son is being kind to me.
It matters not, he said. The light, slanted gold between the slender beeches and all the silver leaves shivered together. Sasha's horse took exception to the shimmer and reared up. Sasha checked him mid-leap and set him back on his haunches. Buran came up beside them, as though showing the colt how a real horse behaved.
You have heard what the monk has to say, said Pyotr slowly. The grand prince and his son are our kin. But Sasha, I would ask you to think better of it. It is a harsh life, that of a monk. Always alone, poverty and prayers and the cold bed. You are needed here.
Sasha looked sideways at his father. His sun-browned face seemed suddenly much younger.
I have brothers, he said. I must go and try myself against the world. Here, the trees hem me in. I will go forth and fight for God. I was born to it, father. Besides the prince, my cousin Dmitri, he has need of me.
It is a bitter thing, growled Pyotr, to be a father whose sons abandon him, or to be a man with no sons to mourn his passing.
I will have brothers in Christ to mourn me, Sasha rejoined, and you have Kolya and Alyosha.
You will take nothing with you, Sasha, if you go, snapped Pyotr. The clothes on your back, your sword, and that mad horse you think to ride, but you will not be my son.
Sasha looked younger than ever. His face showed white under the tan.
I must go, father, he said. Do not hate me for going.
Pyotr did not answer. He set Buran for home with such a vengeance that Sasha's colt was left far behind. Vasya crept into the stable that evening when Sasha was looking over a tall young gelding.
Mish is sad, said Vasya. She wants to go with you.
The brown mare was hanging her head over her stall. Sasha smiled at his sister.
She is growing old for journeys, that mare, he said, reaching out to stroke her neck. Besides, there is little use for a brood mare in a monastery. This one will serve me well.
He slapped the gelding, who flicked his pointed ears.
I can be a monk, said Vasya,
and Sasha saw that she had stolen her brother's clothes again and stood with a small skin bag in one hand.
I have no doubt, said Sasha, but monks are usually bigger.
I am always too small, cried Vasya in great disgust. I will get bigger. Don't go yet, Sashka, another year.
Have you forgotten Olya? Said Sasha. I promised I'd see her to her husband's house. And then I am called to God, Vasochka. There is no gainsaying.
Vasya thought a moment.
If I promised to see Olya to her husband's house, could I go too?
Sasha said nothing. She looked down at her feet, scraping a toe in the dust.
Anna Ivanovna would let me go, she said all in a rush. She wants me to go. She hates me. I'm too small and too dirty.
Give her time, said Sasha. She is city bred. She is not used to the woods.
Vasya scowled.
She's been here forever already. I wish she'd go back to Moscow.
Here, little sister, said Sasha, looking at her pale face. Come and ride.
Vasya, when she was smaller, had loved nothing more than riding on his saddle bow, her face in the wind, safe in the curve of his arm. Her face lit, and Sasha put her on the gelding. When they came into the dvor, he sprang up behind.
Vasya leaned forward, breath quickening, and then they were off, galloping with a swift thunder of hooves. Vasya leaned gleefully forward.
"More! More!"
she cried when Sasha eased off the horse and turned him for home.
"Let's go to Sarai, Sashka,"
she turned to look at him.
"Or Tsargrad, or Buyan, where the Sea King lives with his daughter, the Swan Maiden. It is not too far. East of the sun, west of the moon."
She squinted up as though to make sure of their direction. "A bit far for a night's gallop," said Sasha. "You must be brave, little frog, and listen to Dunya. I'll come back one day."
"Will it be soon, Sasha?" whispered Vasya. "Soon?"
Sasha did not answer, but then he did not have to. They had ridden up to the house. He reined in the gelding and put his sister down in the stable yard.